Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of This Week in Wealth. I'm Andrew Forsch, the deputy editor of CityWire RIA. And if you're a regular listener, you might be wondering, where is the usual host with the cool accent and the refined podcasting skills? Well, I can tell you I have not staged a coup. This is a temporary change. Alex Steger is down in, is it Chicago? I believe he's in Chicago at Morningstar's annual conference, where he is joined by our other host, Mr. Ian Wenick. And while I don't want to give too much away, I can tease that they are setting up a really exciting episode for next week with a very special guest. That's next week in Wealth. For now, I am joined by my esteemed colleagues and friends, CityWire RIA senior reporter Sam Bojarski and reporter Alec Rich, who are together in the studio in CityWire's New York City newsroom. And guys, I admit, I've got a little FOMO here. I'm 200-some miles away, dialing in from HQ2, aka my home here in D.C. It's good to see you guys. How are you both?
Good. Good, doing well. It kind of feels weird that you know, a lot of our colleagues have fled the city in such a crazy time. But we're with the Knicks winning and everything like that, but we're staying put. It's been
I was gonna say, I mean, outside of the Knicks parade, there's no place I'd rather be than with you two. So happy to be here.
I was gonna say, yeah, for our native New Yorker, must be floating high on the World Championship. It is generous, Alec, of you to be here taping this podcast instead of being out on the street for the parade. I can't promise that I would have made the same choice in your shoes, but I do respect and admire your dedication to the craft and to the pod.
Yeah, hopefully my sacrifice won't be forgotten, but I did get my fill the other night when they won. I was in Times Square, so I'll take that as a win.
Certainly a rowdy scene, I'm sure. Well, we are sort of tasked. It's a tall task. We've got to kind of push the ball forward here on what I think has been universally accepted as the summer of scoops. Now, I don't think, if memory serves, I don't think that we've kind of broken any major stories this week on kind of mega deals or big sales or recapitalization processes, although I do have some inside information that may change in between the time of this taping and the time when the final podcast runs tomorrow. But nevertheless, we do have a lot to talk about. And I want to start with a story that, Sam, you have kind of been the lead reporter here on, and I'm going to ask you to explain what exactly it is. It's a big story. It's got to do with two things that RIAs love to hear about, love to talk about. That's fees and Charles Schwab. So would you set us up? And yeah, what is the story exactly, Sam?
Yeah, so Charles Schwab, of course, they're the largest custodian of RIA assets in the country. They've kind of modeled their business since, you know, maybe around like 2019 or so on zero commission trading. And early this year, they kind of made an announcement to RIAs who custody with them, that they were going to start instituting a $5 per account, fee for block trades. And yeah, that kind of, you know, caused a stir among the RIA community. And there's been a number of changes and delays, I suppose, to that policy since then. But that's,
well, let me stop you right there before we get too into the weeds on it. Block trading for the uninitiated, what are block trades and why is a $5, per account fee on such trades important for RIAs?
Yeah. So a block trade is basically when a large institutional manager, an RIA or a fund manager, in this case, obviously an RIA, wants to trade, a single stock across many different accounts. And they basically send that trade request to, an investment bank or another institution. In that case, that would be Charles Schwab, basically to get a good price, and a price that isn't going to, like move the market and cause, you know, some massive fluctuation and cause their position to go down. So that's what Schwab's block trade does. It executes those trades on behalf of RIAs.
And at $5 per account, I mean, if you're making a trade across hundreds or maybe even thousands of client accounts, that fee can really rack up and be a meaningful cost to a small business like an RIA.
Yeah, it really can. And yeah, we've been talking to RIAs. I've been talking to RIAs, and yeah, some of them have said, you know, in the range of like millions of dollars extra per year that they, you know, could be faced with paying to Schwab if they're with these trades. And like those would usually be fees, at least I understand it, that they would, you know, that the firms would eat themselves and not pass on to clients.
Got it. Good. Well, very interesting. Tell us, because there, as I understand it, there have been sort of a series of fits and starts with this. And you've done some really great reporting this week, and we do have a meaningful update, but I might ask you to kind of flout traditional journalistic principles here, and rather than giving us the new news first, maybe just walk us through kind of the timeline and the chronology of when this fee first kind of was revealed or when it first came out, and then sort of the changes that have happened along the way, including some new details that you've got on what types of trades exactly this fee is going to ultimately apply to.
Yeah. So this was first announced to RIAs right at the start of the year, like around January, that this block fee would take effect. And it was supposed to start in March initially, and RIAs kind of complained, they gave their feedback to Schwab and it was eventually pushed back to June 1st. And it did indeed take effect on June 1st. So yeah, so it's been instituted. Firms are paying it in some capacity, but there's been a number like specific trades that have been exempted, as of the last couple months, ETF RFQ trades or request for quote trades have been exempted from the fee, which impacts positively, I suppose, heavy ETF investors.
What exactly is an RFQ trade? This is basically, as I understand it, is this when you would ask multiple different custodians or brokerage firms for their price on a certain asset, I gather?
Yeah, exactly. A request for, asking multiple trading houses for a quote.
And so those trades will be exempted. So what kind of trades are going to be subject to this fee? You've done some wonderful reporting this week on exactly that. We've gotten some more clarity on what exactly is going to be subject to this.
Yeah, so like high touch stock trades mostly, in trades that are over $1,000 in notional value.
High touch. This means what? Essentially, trades that have to run through the block desk. High touch just meaning Schwab has to spend more money, basically employing people on this block desk to effectuate those trades, and therefore they're passing some of that cost along to the advisors.
Yeah. Yeah, just like very large trades that require a human in the loop, by Charles Schwab. Yeah,
good, fascinating. I have a few follow up questions. I think the most pressing of which is, and forgive me if we don't know the answer to this. This is Schwab. What about other custodians? Is this something that the other major custodians? Really, I'm basically referring to one. I'm referring to Fidelity here. Does Fidelity charge a block trading fee, or is this a new thing that basically only RIAs on Schwab's platform are going to have to contend with now?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question. And they do. Fidelity does charge for certain block trades for RIAs, and they've been doing that. I understand for some time. So Schwab isn't. They're not exactly doing anything new that hasn't been done before.
Okay, interesting. Well, my obvious follow-up question there is, and forgive me if I'm bringing us down, into territory where we can't shed as much light as we might like to. What exactly does Fidelity charge? Is it more? Is it less? Is it the same as what Schwab charges?
Yeah, they've historically charged the same. They've had a $5 fee on certain special block orders. Yeah.
$5. Interesting. Okay. Well, I also would be curious. I mean, in your reporting, like, have you spoken with any advisors? Have you gotten any color from RIAs on kind of how they're feeling about this?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I said that, you know, some are really concerned about facing more fees from block trading. And then there's also an interesting kind of conundrum that firms are facing with regard to like best execution. You know, these firms are kind of obligated to act in clients' best interests when they're trading. And the question is, you know, do they use the block desk or do they instead use algorithmic trading, which Schwab has, and which Schwab has said RIAs can use basically for free instead of incurring this fee? But then
as a workaround, interesting. Okay.
As a workaround. But then with algorithmic trading, there's a question of are they going to get that best execution kind of without the human that they really need? So basically there's concerns around whether, RIAs have varying comfort levels, it seems like, with algorithmic trading.
That is a really interesting facet to this. Maybe some tension there between the bottom line and kind of what's reasonable for them as, you know, business owners, business operators, versus the obviously regulatory requirement of doing what is absolutely best for the client at all times.
Yeah, exactly.
Good.
Well,
have
had to shift kind of their model to the algorithm, which is never easy to have to do that.
Well, it seems that RIAs have spoken out. They have voiced their concerns, and Schwab has made some amendments to the policy. Obviously, they delayed. They exempted a few types of trades. So now that fee is in effect, and we will see how RIAs adjust to it. We could go on, but we do have other great stories to get to, one of which, Alec, you wrote. This is a little bit of a shifting gear here, and it is something that we've talked about on the pod before. Two of the largest RIAs in the country have buried the hatchet on a legal beef. The companies in question are Mariner Wealth Advisors and Edelman Financial Engines. Alec, could you maybe give us a little bit of background on the story and what exactly is new this week?
Sure. Yeah, and I don't know if bury the hatchet is the term we want to use, given kind of how intense the close to the case was. But yeah, this began 2.5 years ago in late 2023. Edelman Financial Engines, one of the largest RIAs in the country, accused Mariner, well, Advisors, you know, one of the other mega RIAs, of essentially poaching 10 of its planners. The suit was amended earlier this year, but essentially that amounted to, as I said, 10 planners over the course of the last several years. And so Edelman was accusing Mariner of stealing its trade secrets and misappropriating those. And we see these types of cases all the time, but really the nature in which this case was settled, I think, may have you know, some kind of long-term consequences for other types of suits like this, which we can get into. But essentially, the judge in the case ruled in favor of Mariner, you know, providing their motion for summary judgment and denying that of Edelman. So Edelman is, you know, free to try to appeal the case or try it again at state court. This was at the federal level. But for the moment, you know, this has kind of drawn to a close a long-running battle between these two mega RIAs.
It is fascinating. And the ruling, I mean, if you really boil it down to kind of one line, basically Mariner has, I mean, this kind of conduct is allowed. You are allowed to go after and hire other advisors. A really fascinating ruling in a really high profile case. I mean, again, we've said it a couple of times now, but two of maybe the 5 or 10 biggest RIAs in the country kind of duking it out in court over advisor poaching, advisor recruiting, you know, contract terms, alleged contract violations. And we do see this all the time in independent RIA land. Obviously, there is no broker protocol or, you know, equivalent kind of advisor protocol here in this space, just given the amount of money that is spent on advisor acquisition the acquisition of the underlying clients and the books of business. But so tell us bring us into the details a little bit. I think the judge made some really fascinating comments about kind of Edelman's arguments and the way that it kind of presented those legal arguments in court.
Right. Yeah, the judge really kind of admonished Edelman for its briefing tactics, you know, also noting that, first of all, Edelman did not present enough evidence through which kind of a jury would be able to find that Mariner had misappropriated its trade secrets. The judge noted that stealing, taking confidential information with some value does not automatically equate to a trade secret, which I thought was pretty interesting. And ultimately, the judge noted that Edelman's tactics complicated the court's review and were not in line with the federal rules of civil procedure or the district rules, noting specifically that Edelman at times misrepresented evidence and tried to modify it to fit its narrative and failed to argue against Mariner's facts or support its own with pinpoint citations to the record. So that all kind of obviously played severely against Edelman's favor in that ruling. And the judge noted that that wasn't necessarily a one-off. They appeared throughout Edelman's briefing, and the judge actually named one of Edelman's corporate representatives, specifically kind of shouting them out as kind of a reason for some of those issues, which is in kind of the full ruling itself. And then, you know, later on, we can get into this as well, but, you know, the judge noted that Edelman's position was essentially a slippery slope because it could, you know, federalize every case involving these restrictive covenants that, you know, would render it them unnecessary, essentially, given that Edelman didn't present enough evidence. You know, it would really, as I said, federalize every case in which there's some kind of slight allegation of you know, stealing of trade secrets, even if someone's just, you know, calling upon someone that an advisor who left is calling upon, you know, let's say a family member or what have you, then you would have to theoretically bring some kind of trade secret case for every single one of those individuals that they recall, which obviously is, you know, would be
just not tenable.
Right. So yeah, that was super interesting as well, and could have potential implications for other types of suits like this.
Well, it is fascinating. I would wonder, and you know, we haven't really talked too much about this, but I would wonder if, I mean, obviously Edelman is headquartered in California. I think a lot of their advisors are out of California. I don't know how many of the advisors who left to Mariner are in California, but obviously that is a state that has particular laws that basically make null and void any kind of non-competition clause in a post-employment contract. They make it very difficult to even enforce like a non-solicit. Does that play into it at all? I mean, state laws, I mean, are there certain precedents that might come out of this? I don't know. What's your kind of take?
Yeah, I mean, Edelman tried to play a couple of those state law claims, but those were ultimately dismissed for kind of a lack of subject matter jurisdiction in the case. So I think it really depends. I think a couple of those advisors were, you know, based in California, to my understanding. So yeah, I think it's really kind of a state by state basis. But you know, I think just moving forward for a lot of firms, kind of on the prowl, looking to, you know, sue for some of these poaching claims, I think they need to kind of be able to be ready to bring a lot more hard evidence to the table, rather than maybe circumstantial in some cases. I mean, Edelman went so far as to kind of accuse Mariner's CEO, Marty Bicknell, of helping in this effort. And, you know, even that was kind of unsuccessful, as we saw with the outcome.
What was Marty accused of doing? I remember that story. It was a while back, but so he was personally placing, allegedly, of course, placing recruiting calls directly to advisors.
Right. Yeah. That was the accusation, which were, you know, ultimately it didn't, you know, amount to, you know, the misappropriation of trade secrets, as the judge found.
Yeah. Yeah, good. Well, it's interesting because I'm seeing some amount of overlap between this case and the case of, you know, there's another really high profile poaching case involving OpenArc Corporate Advisory, one of the larger, actually definitely the largest wirehouse breakaway team, which was sued by Merrill Lynch for poaching, you know, this entire kind of institutional and corporate advisory team. And as you reported, as we've talked about on the pod, Alec, I mean, you went down to Georgia, to the Atlanta area where that case was unfolding in court. And I think you were in the courtroom when the judge declined or denied Merrill's request for a temporary restraining order against that team and those advisors or the executives who were, you know, trying to bring those advisors over to their new business. And so I'm sensing a little bit of a trend maybe where, you know, when it comes to the independent advisor space, it's a lot more difficult to enforce the terms of these kind of restrictive covenants in advisors' contracts. And it's a lot more difficult to, yeah, basically stop advisors from going where they want to go, and especially from stopping clients from following them.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think a problem we're seeing consistently is just these RAs that are, you know, or just firms that are suing in general are having a very difficult time going beyond kind of circumstantial evidence piece to really show, you know, harder intent in terms of just stealing these trade secrets. I mean, you know, as we've said, you know, firms and advisors are allowed to kind of go where they please to the most extent, or to some extent, I should say. So, yeah, I think that it seems to be kind of a newer trend, I guess, but definitely one to kind of keep an eye on as we see, you know, more of these types of cases roll on here in the coming years.
Yeah, and perhaps speaks to one of the risks inherent in acquisitions, where if you're spending, you know, top of line, top of market valuations to buy a business, or you're spending a lot of money on a recruiting bonus or something, firm's got to be mindful of the possibility that that advisor, if they find themselves unhappy or dissatisfied, you know, it's going to be a difficult fight to get them to stay on your platform if they do want to leave. And of course, you know, this is, it's kind of a cliche, but this is a people business, and the client tends to value the relationship with the advisor over the brand, right? I mean, firms spend all of this money on branding and kind of brand recognition, partially for that reason, to kind of keep clients and keep assets on the platform. But that doesn't always take. So speaks to one of the risks inherent in advisor M&A and advisor recruiting bonuses and things of that nature. So a fascinating story. Read more of Alex reporting on that for more details. There is one more story that I think we would be remiss if we didn't touch on, and that is the SpaceX IPO. I mean, it's broken all kinds of records. It was maybe the biggest story in public markets, you know, over the last couple of weeks. So I don't really have too much prepared to talk about it, to be honest, guys. But I don't know, Sam, maybe I'll ask you first. Anything interesting that you have seen coming out of the SpaceX IPO beyond just the sheer size and scale of the listing itself?
Yeah, space is the place. I mean, tons of interesting angles here. I mean, one of the big things is there. You know, this whole IPO has minted, you know, tons and tons of new millionaires. And you know, future IPOs for Anthropic are going to do the same thing. And there was this one a big employee group from SpaceX that kind of banded together and you know, tried to evaluate partnering with different RIAs. They eventually landed at Corio, and kind of got preferable fees. I think like 0.5% on AUM. Yeah, and they'll be working with Corio, but we can expect like more of these groups to partner with RIAs to manage their wealth from selling their shares.
Really interesting. And Corio, a large kind of Chicago area RIA, what are they, 20 billion, 15 billion, something like that? They're a large firm.
Yeah.
They're a large firm, and it's a big win for them. I mean, you look at some of the other firms that SpaceX employee group was evaluating, and it's big names. I mean, I think there were some wirehouses in there. There were some true kind of mega RIAs. I think Creative Planning, Corient maybe in the mix, both kind of serial acquirers. But yeah, it speaks to the purchasing power that you get as an ultra high net worth account or group. I mean, if they're moving as one unit, yeah, you get some major purchasing power, and yeah, you can undercut that kind of standard 1% fee that an RIA might charge. I don't know exactly what Corio's kind of specific fee schedule is, but yeah, I mean, 50 basis points, not bad for those employees. And as you mentioned, yeah, a couple other kind of mega IPOs on the docket for later this year, including Anthropic and OpenAI as well. So we'll be curious to see if, you know, maybe some shareholders from those firms, take a page out of the book here of the SpaceX employee group. It's funny you say space is the place. I've got my Sun Ra t-shirt on right now. So topical. Alec, anything to add on SpaceX IPO here before we wrap?
Yeah, maybe not specifically on SpaceX, but on some of these other, you know, free IPOs, you know, be it Anthropic or OpenAI. And I've heard some discussions about issues with secondary stock sales. You know, everyone's obviously clamoring to get access to these. And last month, Anthropic's board kind of cracked down on some of those platforms, you know, Forge Global being one of them, which Schwab bought last year that we reported on. And you know, in that case, Anthropic essentially said, you know, you guys don't have access to these, you know, these free stocks, right? They said that unless it's approved by us, you know, you can't access it. I think Forge at the time said that, you know, they were working to remove themselves from that list. But I did hear from folks that, you know, certain RIAs, you know, were potentially promising, you know, folks access to those via some of those platforms. And so I think that's just something to keep an eye on as well. And as, you know, obviously folks are clamoring for all these stocks before they IPO. And, you know, it's creating a lot of, I think, confusion and angst as well.
It is interesting, and it speaks to, I mean, obviously we're talking about companies that are private, which are then going public, but it does speak to this wider trend, excuse me there, of RIA clients kind of increasingly moving down market towards the retail kind of mass affluent space who are looking for access to private markets or things like pre-IPO shares that they couldn't get on their own through their advisors. And so, yeah, speaks to kind of that rising demand and just another thing that RIAs have to kind of add to their service menus or figure out a way to communicate with clients. So fascinating stuff. Check out our future reporting on those subjects for more. I think that's all for now. Yeah, Sam and Alec, thank you guys. This has been a pleasure. Next week's episode is going to be a real heater. So do tune into that. And we will see you again soon right here on This Week in Wealth.